Welcome to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable, where real people share real stories. We're coming to you from the Marriott McAllen Edinburgh Studio, right here in the heart of the Rio Grande Valley, the front line and the gateway of the USA. I'm Rico ATP, and riding with me is the one and only Quad Father.
They see me rolling.
And today we're joined by a familiar voice of To The Roundtable. Victoria from Episode 4 is with us as guest host, bringing her perspective, insight, lived experience to today's conversation. With just an ATP and a quad, plus one powerful advocate, a microphone, a mission, and a whole lot of passion. This podcast is about real people, real stories, and real power. Spotlighting life after injury, adaptive technology, and the voices reshaping what it means to roll forward. Crushing stigmas one episode at a time. So buckle up, because at this roundtable, we're not talking, we're building a movement. How's everybody doing?
Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas.
It went by so fast.
It did.
And Ms. Victoria, give us an update. What you've been up to since you were on our show?
So I think I was on the show, in August?
I believe so, yeah.
And then, in September, they told me I re-herniated my disc, so I had a third spinal cord surgery. And from the first herniation from when I was in high school.
The very first one?
Yes. And then that was re-herniated. I guess something like of the screws or something messed up. I don't know what the heck is down there. But so I had surgery in September. And then, I went through a little hard time, rough patch there. Picked myself back up because I did lose my job. Mm-hmm. And then now I have a new career job, so I'm going through that, and it's going super good. It's work from home, so.
Excellent.
Yeah, just there, chilling in the chair. Even though my back still hurts after the 8 hours just sitting there.
Really?
Yeah, my back is a pain sometimes. And then I fell on New Year's, so it didn't make even better. I fell in my garage. It was bad. I was, kicking the garage door and banging on the door, and Martin, my boyfriend, was in the living room. And my dog, so he got me a puppy for Christmas. She was, because her food's in the garage, that's why I went in there. And she was crying and crying for me at the door. And I was like, it's so bad. So bad. But no, we're doing better. And I'm just happy to be here. I'm honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We're so happy here.
I remember when we got all pumped when we saw you, that video of you throwing the ball in therapy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. So I did do therapy. I unfortunately had to get discharged early from therapy because of starting my new job. So I was kind of scared to ask for time off. Going through the experiences from my previous employer. Huh? So I didn't want to mess that up. So I just discharged from therapy earlier. And so I didn't finish the round of therapy.
Well, but yeah, you were throwing that softball. You had that natural throw and everything.
Yes.
It was so dang cool, man.
Thank you. It was tough, but it was fun. It felt really good. Just muscle memory to be back there.
Well, it looked great. Being a former softball coach from a little league, I was like, man, that's perfect right there. And Mr. Quadfather, what's up with you?
Well, I just started back. I had a 2-week break for the holidays. Yesterday was our first day back. And then tomorrow, the students will be back. So, but I was ready to come back. I get bored when I'm not at work.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a teacher, so if I'm not doing that, what am I doing? I guess sometimes that's how I feel. So I just wanted to come back.
But good,
the big news, Mr. Rico Segovia, what happened over the break, my man?
Dude, I'm a grandfather.
Cool.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
First grandbaby. Oh, and then it's a girl. That's like me.
It really?
She's going to be so spoiled.
Oh, she already is. Miss little Lyra Jane Vega. Pounds, close to 7 pounds. She's beautiful, but she has a little bit of, what's it called? When you're yellowish?
Oh, jaundice.
Jaundice, yeah. So she's right now at Driscoll Children's Hospital underneath the UV light, getting that thing taken care of. But oh my gosh.
I was in that tank for a week when I was born, so.
You know what? I think that's actually more normal than not for babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
Okay. Who's that speaking? I don't know. Danny, why don't you let our audience know who we have on the show today?
All right. So today we are honored to welcome a remarkable young woman whose voice is changing the conversation around rare disease, disability, and self-advocacy. Our guest is Giuseana Klauser, born in Napier, New Zealand, and now living in Monroe, Washington. Giuseana began experiencing serious medical symptoms at just 12 years old. Symptoms that were dismissed, minimized, and misunderstood for years. Despite being told it was all in her head, Giuseana never stopped advocating for herself. At 19, she was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and at 21 with Anderson-Towil syndrome, confirming what she had known all along. Today, she also lives with a tethered spinal cord and continues to navigate life with incredible courage and determination. Giuseana is a rare disease advocate, a motivational speaker, and currently holds the title of Miss Wheelchair Washington USA. Her platform is built on a powerful truth. Rare isn't rare. Through education, advocacy, and life experience, she empowers people with disabilities to know their rights, use their voices, and advocate for themselves. Beyond advocacy, Tiziana is also an accomplished artist, with her work set to be displayed at the Kennedy Center, proof that creativity and impact have no physical limits. As she prepares to compete for Miss Wheelchair USA in July 2026, Tiziana continues to pursue her goal of education, purpose, and what she simply describes as wanting to feel like she is living a life. Welcome to the show, young lady.
Hi, thank you guys for having me on.
Oh, no, thank you for coming on. You've got a remarkable story. I found you on social media. You know, our podcast is new. We're 4 months in, but we have a pretty big following. We actually have a pretty good market in the state of Texas. And you stood out to me, and I'm so glad you accepted our invite. So how are you doing today?
I am doing all right. I'm recovering from some medical situations that happened over the weekend. Lots of paperwork and, you know, all the advocacy and self, you know, all the stuff you got to do, contacting insurance, all the work that goes into living with a rare disease or a chronic illness. I've been pretty busy with that, but otherwise I'm doing pretty good.
Oh, that's great. So for those who are meeting you for the first time, how do you usually introduce yourself? I mean, outside of the diagnosis and outside of your titles?
Yeah, I mean, usually I introduce myself. I talk about my art. If people ask me what I do, I say I'm an advocate and an artist that I paint. Usually I'll, you know, sometimes I'll mention the competitive speed painting and just talk about myself and just what I do in my day-to-day life. And a large part of that is my medical stuff, but there's more to me than that, you know, my love for animals and aquariums and art. So that's just, you know, that's the gist of it.
Gotcha. And you were born in New Zealand. When did you come to the States?
I think I was like 3, but we kind of hopped back and forth, was visiting a few times when I was younger. My dad's side of the family is from New Zealand. And while I no longer have an accent, there are videos out there of me as a young child with my little accent, correcting my mom and her American accent and telling her that her American pronunciations of words were incorrect.
How cute.
A little know-it-all.
I'm going to look for that.
Yeah.
So when we talked yesterday on a pre-show call, I was taken back as far as your diagnosis. I was not familiar with it. The EDS. So Danny has done some research. I know he did some of this study when he was at the university, correct, Danny?
Yeah. It's when I got my master's, I did. I was really always interested in genetics and some of these really rare diseases. And they're so tricky, and there's so many of them, and what causes them, what you can do with them. So one of the ones that you were diagnosed is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, is that correct?
Yes. Okay, so my two primary diagnoses are EDS and ATS.
Yeah, and ATS stands for, that's Anderson-Tawil syndrome, which is probably even more rare disease.
Yes. So the subtype of EDS that I have is estimated to affect around 1 in 5,000. Anderson-Tawil syndrome is estimated to only impact about 7,800 in the world, so just under 8,000 patients worldwide. And there's so much less research on it and just less awareness in general.
Yeah. So what I found on Anderson-Tawil syndrome, because that's super, I mean, if you think about it, there's 8 billion of us, right? And there's only 8,000. So I don't know what the percentage of that is, but it's really rare. Some of the symptoms are like muscle weakness, periodic paralysis, irregular heartbeats, and it has something to do with your, I'm going to nerd out a little bit, but like it affects your potassium channels. When it comes to our nerves, for example, we have something called a sodium potassium pump, and there's always like sodium and potassium going in and out of our nerves whenever we're doing something, right? Whenever we're doing an action. And when that gets thrown off, it creates problems, right? And like, think about your heart, for example. It's got like this, it's on a timer, right? Like the lub-dub, right?
Bump, right.
Bump, bump. And if something is off with that pump, it's going to throw it off of it. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of people will experience weakness, right? Because sometimes the heart's not pumping properly. And you get these really weird arrhythmias and things like that. So this is some of the stuff on the Anderson-Tawil syndrome. But for the EDS, right? Super rare, like you said, 1 in 5,000, depending, because there's about 13 types. So from 1 in 5,000 to about 1 in 20,000, depending on the type that you have. And there's like the hypermobile joints, which is like, I guess, loose joints. I can cause like chronic pain, sometimes bruising, fatigue, autonomic issues like dizziness and rapid heart rates as well, gastrointestinal issues. But at the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with your connective tissues, right? So like blood and adipose, which is your fat, and cartilage and ligaments and tendons and bones. And all these things are important, right? Because they protect and they bind our tissues together, right?
Okay.
And if something is off with those, right, you're not going to have proper function, right? And it can wreak havoc on just daily life. Sometimes just little things, it feels like you're clumsy a little bit, but it's just really, you know, it's just your joints not working properly. And I don't know how you got diagnosed. Sometimes it could be physical exams. Sometimes it's a genetic test. And there's no cure for it. You just kind of manage it with physical therapy or pain management, sometimes bracing. It can be mild to life-threatening. And I know any of you probably get to this a little bit later, but a lot of times it goes undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. Because it shows a lot of similarities to other things. And and it's also complicated because sometimes it's inherited, sometimes it just happens by chance. Yeah. Yeah, so it's one of those things that could be really, really complicated. I'm sure Jizya can share some of the things. Did I miss anything there, or is there anything that you'd like to add to that?
No, yeah, you mostly got it. I would like to expand a little bit on the mechanism of Andersen-Tweil syndrome specifically. So like you were saying, the sodium-potassium pump, the ion channel, that functions as a gate in between your cells. So it pushes and pulls the potassium in and out of your cells, and your muscles kind of mean that. You can think of it kind of like cocking a gun. You need it in order for your muscles to be able to fire. And for me, due to my genetic condition, certain triggers like exercise or stress or the wrong types of food, certain medications, getting cold is a big one for me. And those cause the ion channels to kind of freeze up or be leaky. And so for me, the ion channels freeze and the potassium, even though I still have the correct amount of potassium in my body, it gets trapped in my cells and my body cannot use it. And so when your potassium drops, that causes your muscles to not be able to fire. And so for me, periodic paralysis attack from Andersen-Tweil syndrome will look like either just severe weakness in my whole body or severe weakness in my legs, or it can even go full body paralysis where I cannot open my eyes, I cannot speak. And in the past, I have gone into respiratory failure because my diaphragm will paralyze and I stopped breathing. And so there's a huge variation in severity of it. My siblings have similar symptoms. The family history has been traced back to my great-great-grandfather for that. And then for the connective tissue disorder, the reason it impacts so many issues, the reason Ehlers-Danlos impacts every system of your body is because it is a collagen production issue. And so your connective tissue is the glue of your body. It's in 95% of your body. And so when your collagen, which is in every part of your body, is faulty, then every part of your body malfunctions. So you have issues with your veins, you have easy bruising, joint dislocations, muscle tear, nervous system issues, immune system issues. Everything just goes haywire and it can open you up to so many comorbidities, which is why so many people who have connective tissue disorders like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome have a whole handful of diagnoses. Like I think technically I have 36 different diagnoses, which sounds like a lot and can medically discredit you. However, they're all caused by the EDS. So in effect, I just have EDS, but it's causing all of these other issues and all of these other diagnoses and complications.
You used to start experiencing some of these symptoms when you were 12, correct?
Yeah. And I mean, I had symptoms a lot younger than that, but it didn't start impacting my day-to-day life and just making me miserable until I was around 12. And 12 is when I started having a lot more complications and things like that.
What symptoms was your body telling you, like, man, this isn't right? I mean, what were you experiencing at that age where it was a concern?
I mean, I'd say from around age 5, I would come home from like preschool and I would have a fever from doing too much. I was always in pain. I'd have electric zaps down my spine at a young age. I was actually born with a bump on the back of my head, which progressively caused more pain as I got older. Around 12, that pain in my head continued to get worse. A couple years before that, I started like almost fainting when I would take a shower. Just a lot of joint pain. Around 12, I started developing a lot more allergies and immune some symptoms, and we ended up going to a neurosurgeon for the bump on my head, which turned out it was a meningocele, which is basically when your meninges, which is the lining around your brain, it is outside of your body. So my meninges had pushed out of my skull when my skull was forming. And so there is a sac of meningeal tissue and CSF fluid outside of my skull. And that was what was causing the pain. So I had that removed when I was 12. I started having a lot of brain fog issues and memory issues and joint pain around 13, 14. I lost my memory when I was 14. Allergies started popping up. Always injured. I was always said to be clumsy, but it was because, you know, I was having dislocations and sprains from my connective tissue failing. And it just kind of progressed. When I was 15, I picked up my dog to give him a bath, and I immediately felt really severe abdominal pain. And we went to ER after ER, just desperate for answers. They did imaging. They did, you know, they checked out loud appendicitis and gallbladder issues and all of that. And they ended up sending me to a pain rehab clinic at 15 years old, who told me my pain was in my head. I needed to try hypnosis because I was crazy. And that if I accepted my illness or used mobility aids or took breaks or voiced my pain, then I would never accomplish anything and never be a good daughter or sister or future spouse or student unless I just pushed everything down and hid it, because in their words, it was not real. And so at that point, I had felt really burnt out because every doctor in my life had said I was crazy. A coworker of my dad recommended a surgeon in Pennsylvania, and we flew to him on a last ditch effort. I did not want to go. I was 17 at this point. I did not want to go at all. And I went, and he did an MRI, and he's like, okay, so we're doing surgery tomorrow. He ended up going in. My abdominal muscles, my abs, my rectus abdominis muscles had completely ripped off from my pelvis. I had compartment syndrome in both of my abs and in my right adductor, which is the inner thigh muscle. And he was the first one who first brought up the possibility that I could have a connective tissue disorder. I did not, however, receive a diagnosis for almost 2 years after that, when things just continued to get worse. And yeah, the gaslighting has gone on since I was about 5 years old. Gaslighting my mom, saying she's just being overdramatic. Gaslighting me, saying I'm just a teen who wants to get out of school.
Oh, everything. My gosh. Tori, can you relate to anything she's saying?
Yes. Like, so I have a lot of like neuropathy pain. I know you mentioned those like shocking zapping pain that you said you experienced after mine. So I experienced those after my surgery now, maybe like 40 to 60% of the time, just because they happen randomly. Like, I still haven't figured out why they pop up or, you know, affect me the way that they do. So when I say that I'm so in so much pain, like, I scream like if I'm a crazy person, and friends and family will be like, are you okay? Like, you know, they would just look at me weird. The ones who truly cared about me were truly worried. But other than that, it's like, don't think about it. It's all in your head, or just don't pay attention to it. But it literally takes over your mind and like controls your body, you know, because these things, these shocking pains are just happening out of nowhere, at least for me and my experience. So again, I cannot pinpoint as to why they come about as they do. Like, am I walking too much? Am I being too physical, or things of that sort, that they just pop up? Or is it really in my mind? Like, if I'm imagining it's happening, it's going to pop up. But no, and these diagnoses that you're explaining to us, this is the first time that I've ever heard of them. So I'm very sorry that you go through that. But it seems like it's coming from all aspects, from the brain, the heart, the nervous system, that literally affects every little thing that you do. So I know you said that you had, technically you have multiple diagnoses, about 30 something, compared all starting from that prior, the first diagnosis. And I also relate to that as well. Yeah. So mine isn't genetic. Mine just happened, a traumatic spinal cord injury. But one thing, my CES led into something else. And I know I got like a lot of UTIs because of my bladder dysfunction wasn't properly, you know, working. A bunch of others. So I was seeing like endocrinologists, or I was seeing a urologist. There's a bunch. All these doctors just come into play after your one big diagnosis, because, and these are rare, so not a lot of people know about them, or doctors even know how to treat them. So it's kind of, in reality, it's a sad world, but you know, you learn as you go through these things and try to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's, you know, when, like you said, a lot of people don't know about it. Like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome in particular, doctors usually only get about half of a textbook page. And if they're lucky, a 5 or 10 minute lecture in their entirety of medical school. And that's for Ehlers-Danlos, which is much more common than a lot of the rarer conditions like Andersen-Tawil syndrome. So there's definitely a lack of education and awareness, and that impacts the quality of care and the delay in the diagnosis that people fight for.
Yes, I agree. Now, so I have a question. Being here in the States, do you feel like the healthcare system would have been better? Because you said you're from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they have specialists around this area over there compared to here in the United States?
So in New Zealand, there's about, I think, 6 million people for the population. And is only about 48 neurologists in the country.
My gosh.
I have considered moving back there because the weather is better. However, I contacted every single neurologist in the country and they all refused to take me as a patient because they felt they were not equipped and that I should just stay here. So getting a diagnosis and getting adequate care there, even for common issues, is extremely difficult. And unfortunately, even though I would love to be back there, they just do not have the resources to help me. Like even here, I have to go out of state, out of country to find doctors who can treat me. And it would just be even worse there.
Yes, I'm sure, because the population is just so small over there. So you don't have
half of the
people
that.
That's available for you over there than there is here. And that's because you're still struggling.
Yeah, and then also like medical students and doctors there, they'll go to medical school and then they will find a job in America or in Europe or elsewhere because it pays better. So they call it the brain drain. Everybody goes to school and then leaves. So there's not a lot of professionals and researchers and things like that there.
How does the weather affect you? You said it's better over there. Is it just the heat thing?
It's more moderate there, so they are warmer more of the year, but they also just don't get as cold. Andersen-Tawil syndrome, for me, the cold is one of my fastest acting triggers for paralysis. So if I'm in too cold of air conditioning, or if I'm outside in the cold or the rain, or even if I eat an ice cream cone too fast, sometimes that will set off an episode. And so up here in Washington, we're cold a lot of the time and it rains a lot. And so it would just be better there. And then a lot of the states here in the United States that are warmer get too hot. And if I get too hot, then I'm like losing consciousness and my blood pressure is bottoming out. And it's just hard to find a good moderate in between. And where I'm from in New Zealand is probably the closest I would be able to get to an in between.
You just don't have the resources for the medical team.
Exactly. So I am here and it's took me 2 decades to find an adequate medical team. Not all of them are local to me, but some of them are. So I'm kind of stuck here.
You know, you were talking about how, because it reminded me of another common, it's a more common thing, but a lot of people don't believe them. What they have it's fibromyalgia, where people don't understand the pain that they're coming through or they're experiencing, because it's a hard one too. I mean, fibromyalgia is one that's a little bit more common, but it's kind of similar to where people just don't, it's all in your head kind of thing. And I've heard that a lot before with people that have it, where they're explaining this thing that they have, but it's hard to like pinpoint where it's coming from. And it just reminded me of that. That's because I have some friends that have it and similar plight. They were told it's all in your head. And it was just one of those things where, you know what? I wanted to ask you a specific question. Have you had a pedigree done for your family as far as the disease goes? Because you mentioned some people
like for genetic testing.
Yes.
So I got a exome panel just for neurological conditions done with my mom. and no genes were found. However, we're hoping to be able to get a full genome sequencing to find a genetic mutation. It's either 40% or 60%, I don't remember which one, of patients with Andersen-Tawil syndrome are considered Andersen-Tawil syndrome type 2, which means the genetic gene for them has not been found yet. In the early 2000s, Dr. Tawil ran a study on my friend's family with 108 family members to try and discover which gene was causing their specific mutation of Andersen-Tawil syndrome and was not able to find it. He's actually retired now, and there's pretty much only one researcher working full-time on periodic paralysis. So at the moment, I am not hopeful that a gene will be found, but I'm looking into options for it. However, the opinion of Dr. Tawil saying he thinks I have it and my incredible neurologist thankfully was enough to get the type 2 diagnosis and help me get adequate treatment.
I know for EDS, it could be autosomal dominant or recessive, but the Tawil syndrome one, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about that one.
It is autosomal dominant.
For those of you that don't know dominant,
that would be me.
Go back
you
to
get,
me.
Remember, you get gene from your mom and dad, right? If it's a dominant thing, you just need one copy of it for you to have a disease, right? A lot of traits or diseases, you need both. You need it from mom and dad for it to be able to show. In this case, what makes it dominant is you just need one copy of it and then it'll show, right?
Oh, wow.
That's when you have,
okay.
Now, if it's specific from like mom or dad, then we call that a sex-linked trait or sex-linked disease.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, it doesn't matter. It affects men and women the same, right? So it's called an autosomal dominant. In this case, you just need one copy of it for it to show, right? That's all that means, right? And they do pedigrees. A pedigree is just kind of doing a family history.
Okay.
And you can go back and forth. And the more you test, the better you're able to identify who has it. Mm-hmm. And by looking at this outline, you can tell, oh, you know what, this
who's
going
to get passed to.
Yeah, who's it going to get passed to, or what are your percentages of getting it?
Mm-hmm.
And it, like for an autosomal dominant, it's 50% or more sometimes. If it's a recessive thing, it'll tend to skip generations. It's more like in the 25% range. But that's what we're talking about there. Yeah.
A spontaneous mutation for people who don't have family history is called a de novo mutation. So they did not.
So they can be spontaneous as well. It just happens.
You were told for years that it was all in your head. So what did it finally mean emotionally when you were finally diagnosed?
Just the validation. Like my entire life, I wanted to be normal and to be fixed. But, you know, being diagnosed with something that had no cure, obviously that's hard. But just the validation of knowing something is actually wrong and you're not crazy. Because after years of being told that you're crazy as a child and as an adult and just continuing on your entire life, just the validation of something being there. Lots of people are like, well, you're crazy. Why would you hope for positive test results? Don't you want it to come back normal? Because that means you're okay. It's like, well, I would love to be okay, but I'm not. So the matter is now finding out why I am not. And you can't defeat a monster until you know what the monster is, right? So you can't make progress in getting better until you know what's hurting you. And so like my tethered spinal cord, I was born with that. I was born with the birth defect dimple in my back. I've had issues my entire life with back pain and electric zaps. And I did not get that diagnosed until September of 2025 when I went to Europe for specialized testing. And the validation I felt when he came and he pointed out everything that was wrong with my imaging was unlike anything else. Like incredible just validation. Like, yeah, even if something can't be fixed, knowing what it is can bring so much peace.
So what would you tell someone right now who feels unheard by the medical system?
That you know your body best and somebody out there will believe you. And it might be so hard to find the right doctor. And it is so hard to fight medical burnout and to feel like you're having to fight both your body and the system that is supposedly there to help you. But somebody will do the right testing. And even if all the tests are negative, it just means you haven't had the right test yet. Somebody will be able to find something eventually. And just hold on to that. And if you know something is wrong, keep fighting.
I love that.
Don't get second opinions, get third opinions, get fourth opinions. Just keep going because you know your body better than anybody else. Somebody who is not living in your body cannot tell you what you are experiencing or what you are not experiencing.
So on your hard days, what keeps you grounded and gives you peace?
Oh, that's a hard one. There's a few things. I am a Christian, so I do rely on that. But also just knowing that me sharing my story and me keeping on going is helping other people feel seen, and it's helping other people get help. If I keep sharing my story, somebody out there is going to feel less alone. And that is a large part of what keeps me going, is because even if it does end up being too late for me, even if nothing can be done for me, even if this kills me, which it almost has numerous times, the more I can use my voice, the more people can be impacted and possibly get the help that I couldn't.
Okay. So what misconceptions do people have about this disability? I mean, what would you like to correct them about this?
I think a large part is that it's dynamic. So it's not the same every day. My ability to function fluctuates drastically. Like, my neck will sometimes be dislocated and sometimes it won't be. With the periodic paralysis, some days I will not be able to move my legs and some days I will. Some days I can walk a little bit. Some days I cannot walk at all. You know, I can go from being obviously not completely fine, but I can go from appearing normal and being at an event to on a ventilator within a few hours. And then the next, 3 days later, I can go be doing a professional photo shoot. Like, I had a photo shoot last year for Ms. Wheelchair USA, and I had just come off of a ventilator in that. There was still a scab on my leg from where they drilled into my leg to intubate me and to do an IO catheter. And so when people see me out and about, they assume that I'm fine, or they assume that on my bad days, I must be exaggerating.
Yes, I can relate to that. That's a lot of people dismiss your bad days once they see you have like a little pep in your step, you know, because
exactly.
It really does. Because there was a time when I went out with my sisters and it was a night out and they're like, oh, well, how are you here? Like, shouldn't you be like at home in bed? And it's like, well, I'm feeling pretty good right now. Like, you're making me want to go home in bed. But it's something that you have to ignore those comments because it's really hard. Like, well, aren't you disabled? Shouldn't you be at home or not being able to do this or not being able to do that? Or you look like you're fine, like you're smiling, but in the inside, you know, they don't know exactly what's going on or what you're feeling. Like, these zapping pains, did they give you a diagnosis? I know you said you just got diagnosed in September last year. But what was the diagnosis for those pains? Was it like by chance neuropathy or was it something else?
No, so it's due to my tethered spinal cord. So basically with a tethered cord, your spinal cord is supposed to be freely floating in your spinal canal. But for me, at the very base of my spinal cord, it is fused to my actual spine instead of freely floating. So then instead of just floating in my spinal canal, my spinal cord is being stretched tight like a rubber band. And so any traction on my spine just stretches it tight even more and causes spinal cord damage. But it also, that is the cause of the progressive spinal cord zaps, is it like micro tears or it being pulled tight. And then also because your brainstem is connected to your spinal cord, when your spinal cord is being pulled tight, it also tugs on your brainstem, kind of pulling it down out of your skull. And that is, you know, that causes a brainstem compression, which can also cause the electric zaps.
Yeah, I just think about like whenever you've had like some sort of back pain where you've like herniated disc, for example, right? You've got something pushing up against your spinal cord.
Yeah, that's me.
That you get that weird pain. Just imagine that for your entire spinal cord. Everything's touching up against it, pushing it, pulling it. I can't imagine the pain.
It's unbearable. I just, from experiencing my L3, L4, L5 and affecting my S1, all that, I actually have like fused my disc or fused together. My spinal cord is actually like affected and I get those too, but they keep on telling me it's neuropathy. But one, I have another underlying diagnosis, which is diabetes. So they're like, well, is it because of your diabetes or is it because of your spinal cord injury?
And I think a lot of time they tend to go with the easier thing.
Yes. Yes.
Just what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. I get it, right? I get you always go with a simpler thing first and kind of build your way up. But when you're told over and over again, it's like, dude, it's this thing. At some point, you have to change your mindset. Yeah. You know what? We have to look at something else.
Yeah. So like with me, I feel like it's not the diabetes because when I'm actually getting these shocking nerve pains, I call them shocking nerve pains. It feels like somebody's just stabbing you in that area. Yeah. my toes actually like react. So if this is neuropathy and you have sensation and you have mobility in your feet with diabetes, that's not going to happen. But me, that I don't have sensation or mobility or nothing like that, I literally see my toes react and just boom, like a spasm.
Really?
Yeah, that definitely feels like an actual spinal cord or spinal nerve root issue than just your smaller nerves that cause neuropathy.
Correct. Yes, yes.
So what has your experience taught you about resilience? I mean, at such a young age?
I think it's just, you know, keeping on going and trying to just live your life. And I mean, for a long time, I thought it was normal and that I was just weak. So I thought everybody must be experiencing the things that I experienced. I remember one of the first times I ever felt that way was like first grade on the playground. Like, I didn't understand why everybody could run so easily and why everybody could jump up and down so easily and that they weren't hurting from it. And so I just thought, well, they must just be better at hiding it and I must just be really weak. And so I just got better at hiding it and pushing through. And I didn't know any better until I was older that in fact was not normal. And I think I have learned to be resilient out of necessity. There wasn't really any other option for me, but it definitely taught me to be more empathetic with people because you never know what somebody else is going through and you never know what things they are pushing through to be there or to do what they are doing. And just keeping in mind that me, myself, I have not given up and I'm going through so much. Other people are as well. And just keeping that in mind for everybody. But for me, I don't necessarily know what it's taught me about resilience in general. I just feel like I never really had a choice and I just had to keep on trucking.
Keep on keeping on.
That's what it is. How about you, Victoria?
What kept me on the ground and to keep on going was actually my family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if I mentioned it in my episode, but my brother, he has several disabilities like cerebral palsy, he's paraplegic, things of that sort. So I kind of just want to show him that it's okay to not be okay, if that makes sense. Yeah. Even though we kind of consider him okay, you know, being family, the close bond and stuff, like, oh, he's fine, you know, whatever. But people from the outside would judge or view, or it makes me sad. Before my disability, I would cry for like kids who were wheelchair bound, and it made me feel, I was very empathetic, or I still am very empathetic towards other people, you know. But yeah, just my family, just trying to show them that no matter what you're going through, you have to keep going forward and just do things for yourself because nobody else will do them for you, no matter who it is. When it could be family, you know, they say that they're there for you, and in reality, at the end of the day, like, they're the ones that can judge you a little bit more because they're kind of in the situation with yourself. So it's like, that's true. They get like annoyed or doing something, or you feel like a burden on them. So you just have to do for yourself no matter what.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's been my experience with the medical system as well. A lot of people have the idea that you get injured or you get sick and then you go to the doctor and you get a diagnosis and then you get treatment. Yeah. But it's not that simple. And there's so much you just have to do on your own in order to get anywhere. And I think that's where a lot of people have the disconnect with, well, why don't you just go to the doctor? Or why don't you just go to the emergency room? And it's like, well, it's not really the way it works.
So speaking of being like headstrong, I was told that you were Miss Wheelchair USA. So I want to know more about that because I'm not going to lie to you. I may be your next competition.
Well, I mean, applications are open still for this pageant season, so I can give you some info.
Yes, yes. That sounds so, yeah, much so fun.
Last year, I held the title of Ms. Wheelchair Northwestern USA. This year, I hold the title of Ms. Wheelchair Washington USA. And then nationals, where they crown the Miss Wheelchair USA in July every... Sorry, no, it's held in Ohio every July. I don't know why that... I was like, it's held in July every Ohio. No, that does not words. But yeah, so it's really cool. So it is a pageant, but it is not like, you know, your typical beauty pageant where you go out in your swimsuit and you have people stare at you because that's weird. But like full respect to people who compete in pageants. It is very hard work. However, it's not something I would be comfortable with. But they are very advocacy focused. So you choose your platform issue. For me, mine is rare disease and the diagnostic delay. And you make your social media posts about it. You do your public appearances. And then on competition week, you have a couple interviews. And then you go on stage. You do your speeches. You have questions on stage. You know, you just kind of go through it and you talk about what you're passionate about. And it was definitely out of my comfort zone when I signed up the first time. But the community I found with the other women that I competed with, it was just incredible. Just to be in a room full of other women who are wheelchair users and have these chronic conditions and understand the struggles on a deeper level that nobody else really could. And just the support coming up, it didn't feel like you're competing against. It wasn't like I'm going to win and you're going to win. It was such a community where everybody supported each other. And it was just so amazing. And that's what prompted me to apply to come back for 2026.
Hey, Gisele, a question for anyone listening that's interested in like signing up. What is the process or what are some of the prereqs that are needed for them to do that?
Yeah. So basically, you can email them. Their website, I can even just say their email here. It's forms@thedanefoundation.org. And you just email, you say, hi, I would like an application for Miss Wheelchair USA. And then they'll send you an application and it asks you some basic questions about yourself. It asks you what your platform issue is, how you will go about raising awareness for it, and just some basic, you know, interview questions, and you put together your application package and send in a short video about yourself, and that gets sent to the judges, and the judges will score you independently of each other. If your score is high enough, then you will be granted a title. And then through and that is all virtual. So state and regional level is all completely virtual. You do not have to go in person for a competition. Once you hold a state or regional title, you'll go and July for the in-person week of competition. And it's similar, you know, you fill out the stuff. It's just more in depth about yourself and about your platform, and you practice your speeches and things like that. And then you have the competition week in person. Overall, the application process is pretty easy. It's a small organization. It's a small group of women running it. So I will admit there are some communication delays and things like that for if you have questions, but they are amazing people and really great to work with despite that.
Do you know how many like contestants usually apply or join, or is this like everybody gets like a shot at a title type of thing?
So kind of. It depends. There's generally a state title and a regional title for each area, but it's kind of first come, first serve. So like if you're the first person to apply for Washington in that group of time frame for applications, so like December applications were just judged and announced this week. The only person for your state in that and you score high enough, you will probably get a title. But it is competitive if there are other people competing. But usually on any given year, I think there's between like 20 and 30 contestants that stick through it. There was a lot of people who dropped out last year. So there ended up only being 5 finalists last year, but usually they have quite a bit more than that.
We need to get Victoria.
Yeah, I generally am interested. Yeah. Like I'm asking because I really want to be there.
Message me. I can hook you up because I don't think they have any applications for Texas yet.
Ooh, they have a crown.
I think you'd be a great candidate.
Yeah, she is a model too. So she's very photogenic. She's a very beautiful woman.
Thank you. But no, So I was actually telling Rico and Danny that I really want to be like some type of influencer, especially in the, I don't like to say disability world because, you know, we shouldn't be like put into it. Yes, like that type of thing, because we are all normal in our own way. But just for people to be like seen or heard, or like, because I do promote or not promote, but I do put myself out there on TikTok as well sometimes, like being an advocate. And recently, internally, personally, I've been struggling with finding like outfits because I wear AFOs. So my assistive device are my braces and I wear them daily, almost 24/7 unless I'm home because that's how I get. So that's how I'm mobile. That's how I move around throughout the day or drive or whatever the case may be. So these past couple of weeks for the Christmas break, I had two weddings to go to and I was so sad that I had to wear my braces just because it was like a Western theme. One of them was, which is my hopefully future brother-in-law, my boyfriend's brother got married. So it was a Western theme. Everybody was wearing boots and I was trying to wear a long dress because I had to wear my tennies, but the dress didn't work out with how I imagined it. So I went with a shorter dress and I was still ended up showing my braces. And I know that's not nothing to be ashamed of because I'm actually trying to make people feel better, you know, okay, it doesn't hurt or like you're fine, you still look good or whatever. But me personally, it was just like a little moment of weakness. And then I turned around because I got so many compliments that day of my dress and my hat and everything was like nobody was focusing on my braces but myself, you know. So
I
want to show people that, you know,
you can do it. You can totally have the same thing where you can be completely, you know, hey, I'm not ashamed of my disability, but you can still feel self-conscious about it and you can still be sad about it sometimes. And I think that balance is hard, but it's also important to show that aspect of your life and the fact that, you know, you can hold two things to be true at the same time. You can both be grateful and sad.
Like a hypocrite, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm over here promoting self-awareness and wear what you want and do this. But at the same time, like, oh, there's a little piece of me that's like, oh, should I really be doing this? You know, but
yeah,
I overcome that. So
that's pretty cool. They should have some designer AFOs, man.
Yes. You know what? I was looking into it. So I'm in a bunch of support groups on Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't know if, Jisiana, if you're on a support group on Facebook, but you find a lot of people who are in the same situation with you on Facebook, because I'm in a lot of support groups. But
yeah,
people will share like the type of AFOs they use, the type of shoes and stuff. So
really?
Yeah. I'm actually gonna try to get a specific boot made with a zipper for me, like a customized Western boot.
That's what I was gonna ask you.
Yeah, to go over my brace, but I just don't want it to look so chunky, but you know.
Like a booty?
Yes, yes. Like I have these boots too that I used to use to sleep in. I don't know what they're called, but they keep your foot
for the foot drop.
Yeah, for the foot drop. And they have like this cotton or fur in them. And my sister, she used to call them my Coco Chanel boots.
Oh, I remember you said that.
Yes, yes. So like, it's like, I want to be wearing those throughout the day.
They get hot too.
They do. Well, you know what? I can't even tell you that because I have no sensation. So I can't even feel the temperature in my feet or nothing like that. So I couldn't tell you. But I just know the rest of my body was hot. It was making my whole body.
Jisiana, what excites you most about when you get on stage?
Gosh, it's so nerve-wracking.
Tell me. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, I have always kind of just felt like I want to be invisible, especially with my disability. I'm like, I don't like the looks I get when I'm in my wheelchair. I don't get, like, you know, when I didn't have hair, I didn't like all the looks I'd get when I was, you know, not wearing a wig. And when, you know, just, I just have always wanted to just not be perceived. And so it going and, you know, speaking on a stage and becoming more vocal was very much a jump out of my comfort zone for me. But the thing that excites me probably most is just knowing that what I am saying and using my voice is going to help somebody. And that's just kind of been my whole theme for everything I have done and why I speak out and why I do what I do is just because if even one person takes anything away from what I'm saying, then that's worth it. And that's worth the uncomfortability of being perceived. And, you know, it's just knowing that I could make a difference in somebody's life is what keeps me going. And sometimes I'll get a message from somebody being like, hey, I just want to let you know, I saw your video, I saw whatever else. And, you know, you made me feel seen, or you gave me the idea to talk to this specific doctor, or you motivated me to not give up on my health and I'm okay now. And that just, it reinforces it and makes everything just so much, it's so worth it to know that there are fruits of me speaking and me talking about my experiences and the education I'm putting out. So I just feel like every time I'm speaking, every time I'm doing anything, that's just one more step in the right direction for patients in general and awareness in general.
Drops the mic. Excellent. Mm-hmm. So when you're not rocking the crown, you're also a painter and an artist, correct?
Yes, I am.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, as you know, I had my abs torn off, and so I had to have surgery for that in Pennsylvania, and I had to recover in a hotel room afterwards, and I was bored out of my mind. So we went to Walmart and picked up some like paint by number kits and then some other art supplies, and I just kind of taught myself. And then I was really self-conscious about it, and I didn't want anybody to really see it, but I had ended up in a really bad flare, and I was, you know, extreme levels of pain where I did not want to be alive anymore. And so I made a painting kind of as a therapy for myself, and I, you know, got out of my comfort zone again. And I posted it online on a Facebook support group for one of my conventions. And I had over 20,000 people comment on it and hundreds of people message me asking to buy it. And so many people were commenting and saying, this painting is me. Like, if a picture's worth a thousand words, you know, this explains how I'm feeling. This is the only thing that has ever made me feel seen. And so I kind of took that, and even though it was uncomfortable to open myself up to criticism on my artwork, I started sharing it more, and I started, you know, going to farmers markets. And it's such a good therapy for me, but also just people will come up to me at a market and just start crying, and they'll tell me their story because of my art. And it's opened me up to so many incredible opportunities and made me meet some really incredible people, all because I needed to paint to get my emotions out.
Well, you must have done a great job, because your art's going to be exhibited at the Kennedy Center, correct?
Yeah. So a couple of days ago, I actually got an email for something that I'd completely forgotten I had applied to. It is the VSA Emerging Young Artist Award, and they work with artists with disabilities of any type. And every year they have a art prize competition. It's a juried art show, so you have judges deciding who is going to make it on there, and they look at you and they look at how you're using your voice. This year's theme was, let me see if I can find the name of it. Don't remember what the name was for this year, but it was basically inviting artists to explore how their disability interacts with their art and their voice and how they interact in society. So they have 15 winners every year. And so in March, I will be flying to Washington, D.C., and I will be having a selected piece of my artwork displayed with the other 14 artists at the Kennedy Center from March 13 to April 26, in the museum in Washington, D.C., which I think is really, really cool.
That's amazing.
Didn't really ever anticipate it. I forgot I'd even applied. I almost didn't apply. I saw the deadline for application coming up, and I was like, oh, that's effort.
Yeah.
But I did it. And to me, you know, it's not just an art award like that. It's just another outlet. It's another way for me to get my voice out there, for me to get my mission out there, for me to raise awareness. And, you know, with the Kennedy Center receiving 3 million visitors per year, that's a lot of people who can hear my message and learn about rare diseases and medical everything and just the experience of other patients like me.
That is amazing.
I barely draw stigma.
I can't draw a straight line, bro. I can't draw a straight line.
It's funny, I almost minored in art, actually. I should take that back. At one point before my previous life, I almost minored in art. Yeah. I haven't drawn since then.
But there's different kinds of art, too.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff now, but to actually like pick up, it was just charcoal for me. That was my thing. To pick it up again would be weird.
And that painting that impacted everybody in such a beautiful manner, what did you paint? Can you describe it to me?
So I painted, my colors that I work with are mostly black and blue and gray. So I kind of do like grayscale with a blue tone. And that painting I had done was a woman in pain. kind of holding her face and crying. So like her brow is furrowed and she's clearly in pain. And then I used a lot of drips and water to kind of have drips going down the canvas in a way kind of could be tears. I had some people interpreting it as the drips were almost like bars of a prison that she's behind. There were lots of different ways that people interpreted it, but yeah, that was my grayscale. It was just a woman crying, just a portrait of a woman crying, and it impacted a lot of people. And most of my art is pretty similar. I do a lot of portraits, and most of them are quite either showing emotion or showing physical pain or contortions. And that's kind of my main style.
Is it probably, or maybe it isn't, but is it part of your process whenever you're going through something tough or it's just something that you need to get out? Does it usually come out in your art?
Yeah, it does. So like in September, I had sepsis and I was hospitalized for almost 2 weeks. And one of the things my mom did was she brought me a sketchbook. And some pens because I just needed to draw. And it's really helpful. And I've noticed that if I do art when I am not sad, my art sucks.
The passion like, comes.
Yeah. So it definitely comes out. And I feel like me being actively feeling those emotions, it helps me just convey it onto the canvas in a much stronger and more palpable way.
So we're just looking at a picture of it. That is amazing.
Yeah, we just popped it out right here.
Victoria's popped it up on her phone. Mm-hmm. Good job. Is that the pic? That's not the painting that's going to be at that you selected for at the Kennedy Center, is it?
Oh,
that's
awesome. Which did you pull it up on? Is it on my website?
I went on your website, the Jisiana.art, and there's one that's like kind of collaged with you in the pageant with the girl crying. She's looking down with her hand on the side of the face and her hair is like falling forward. And then the other one is the one that's right above where it says about Jisiana's art, where she's crying in pain.
Yeah. So if you go to the portfolio page, there should be a title on each painting. So it's the one titled Anguish. And then the one that's going in the Kennedy Center is the one that's titled Pressure. And it's the one, it's the side profile where like the back of the head is kind of like exploding out into the top right of the canvas. That is the one that is going in the Kennedy Center.
Pressure. Yeah, I'll look it up.
I see some, but I don't see names on it on the portfolio.
Okay, here, you know what? I can text.
I'm looking through my phone, so I don't know if it's.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, you might not be able to. I'll text you guys a photo of it. That way you can see.
Even better.
The one on the left is the first one I ever shared. And then the one on the right is the one that's going into the Kennedy Center.
Okay. Yeah, we're looking at it right now. We're definitely going to support you with that. It's amazing.
Thank you.
So what's going on with you right now? Do you have anything's coming up as far as besides the pageants or anything you're working on?
Right now, I am mostly just dedicating my time and energy into the pageant season and my medical stuff. I right now have limited energy and very, very high pain. So I only have a couple functional hours per day. So most of that is going towards just kind of the basics that I need to survive, scheduling appointments and contacting doctors and all of the admin. Everything else has kind of taken a backseat, but I decided that I'm going to put in the energy, even if it's energy I don't necessarily have, to compete for Miss Wheelchair USA again, because I just consider it to be worth it and it is a source of joy for me. So even if it does cause me worse pain, it's worth it.
Is a pageant broadcast online anywhere, like on YouTube or a website?
Yeah, so it will be live streamed. They have done like pay-per-view lives, like on actual cable channels. This year, they just streamed it on YouTube, but it's always live streamed on YouTube and I believe Facebook. And then they do backstage live streams on Facebook as well.
You know what we should do? Well, here at our studio downstairs, we've got a bar. It's called Ignite. We should have a watch party.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Right? Mm-hmm. We should try.
That would be really cool. I can definitely send you the details when they are available.
Yeah, we'll work out something. We can invite some of our friends and we'll support you. We'll be cheering from you from South Texas.
That's cool.
Thank you.
I haven't gone back since I've been hurt.
Yeah, you haven't gone back. Yeah, I haven't gone to practice. That's right. Well, Jesiana, we're coming to the end of the show, but this has been a great episode. But I like to finish off with some rapid fire. So I'm going to throw some questions at you.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. So one word you'd use to describe your journey so far?
Complicated and complex. There's just so many moving parts and moving factors and just complexities and complications.
Okay. How about a moment recently that made you smile?
I got a comment on Instagram earlier today with a very sweet 75-year-old man. And he was like, I went to the doctor today and they took a biopsy of my ear. We're not sure what it is, but that's nothing compared to what you're going through. And you're so cute. And congratulations on Miss Wheelchair. And I'll be supporting you. And lots of love from Grandpa George from Rhode Island. And I'm like, I don't know this man, but that is like the most precious, like, so sweet.
We love grandpas. And then,
oh, yeah.
Me. Shout out to you, Mr. Rhode Island.
Yeah. And then sweet. A middle school girl that I actually met at a art show who really liked my art, she reached out and said that in her art class, they have to choose an artist, living or dead, who they admire, and then they have to write why they admire them and then recreate one of their paintings. And she reached out and said she was recreating one of mine, and that just melted my heart. And so I was like, you know, that's nice. Something that made me happy.
What gives you hope right now?
What gives me hope is that I know there are people that care out there, even if they are few and far between. I know that I'm not alone in everything that I'm going through.
If you could speak to your 12-year-old self, what would you tell her?
To believe myself, because believing the people who said I was faking did a lot of damage. And if I had believed myself, that would have changed a lot of outcomes. And then to also not be ashamed of using mobility aids or assistive devices. I carried a lot of shame about using my wheelchair or my walker or my crutches for a really long time. And it took a long time to overcome that. I feel like if I had been not struggling with that at a young age, I would have saved myself a lot of stress and heartache.
Victoria, did you go through anything like that?
I did. So I actually would get a lot of stares using a walker, using my wheelchair, my AFOs. Like I said, I wear a lot of shorts and stuff because just wearing pants with them, it's a hassle. So I do get a lot of stares and I'm just like, yeah, bro, me too. Like you're looking at me like I don't know what's going on, and I do. But I mean, at the end of the day, I have to be proud of everything that goes on throughout the day or that I'm experiencing, because there's other people out there that are going through the same thing. Like, I know I mentioned this, I think, in my episode. I saw a little girl with forearm crutches at Walmart in Alamo, and it made me tear up because she's a little girl. She probably hates herself, or, you know, some people are very proud of themselves, whatever they go through. But you just know what they go through in their mind. So it just, like, made me, like, want to go give her a hug, you know, like, to show her that everything's going to be okay. But yes, I did have a lot of shame in my wheelchair and my AFOs and my braces in the beginning. It took a lot of getting used to. And now it's like, I think we need to think of these things as something that we need and make us better, rather than,
I like that,
rather than like a disadvantage or like a hateful thing. It's like, no, I need to use these to walk. So I'm going to wear them with pride to walk, you know, things.
Yeah,
of that sort.
I definitely agree. And I think there's so much discourse around wheelchair users being wheelchair bound and how it's so tragic you're in a wheelchair. But, you know, that's our freedom. That's what allows us to be able to go out and live a life. That's what allows us to be able to not be stuck at home, bedridden. Like, these are tools, and these are tools of freedom. And they're not something we need to be ashamed about, even if the entire world says we do.
Well said. I know for me, when I get called into a wheelchair clinic and I'm going to design a wheelchair for somebody, my goal is for people to see the person and not the wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So I get very detailed on what I'm going to do on the wheelchair. I have you pick your colors. If you have certain themes, I'll match a theme for you, how you're sitting, how you're self-propelling. I just design it just for you. So something I was like, wow, it looks pretty cool. You know, when you say the word wheelchair, they're kind of like, no.
It's so belittled, huh?
Yeah, and it's kind of it's a moment where they have to accept, like, dude, I'm going to have to use a wheelchair. So it's my job just to make it as functional for you, as comfortable for you, and as badass as I can make it for you. That's my goal. Yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
Okay, last question for you, ma'am. For anyone listening who feels like life has been taken from them, what do you want them to know?
That there is so much more to life than all the dreams that you couldn't have. I still struggle with not being able to live the life that I had imagined, but I also know that some of the best things in my life have come from my disability. The community of people that I found, my best friends that I never would have met if not for my disability and my art career. I would never have had that if I was not sick. And it is sad. And there is grief that comes with not having the life that you imagined. And I still deal with that myself. I can't say that that goes away. But there is more than the things you've lost. And you are more than your diagnosis and more than the dreams that you are not living that you thought you did or thought you would.
I love that.
Yeah, it's true what they say. When one door closes, another one opens. And this isn't obviously a different perspective too. Because like how she said, had she not endured whatever she endured with her diagnosis, she would have never experienced or found out she's an amazing artist.
That's true.
You know? So, and that's true. I feel like no matter how painful, everybody is supposed to be where they're supposed to be.
I like that. Mm-hmm. Any, you got anything for our
guest? Amazing. I don't know why that popped into it during, we were talking about, what were you talking about? I don't know, but one of my favorite lines from a movie, get busy living or get busy dying, right? I just choose to get busy living and keep doing what I got to do to just keep going, right? Yeah. Rather than the alternative.
Giving up.
It's kind of like you said, Danny, they told you just maintain.
Just maintain.
Just maintain.
Right? Baby steps, right?
Yep.
10-minute mile, still a mile.
Yeah. Right. Is Victoria, you got anything you want to close with or?
No, just to keep on pushing. Everybody sees you. We see you. You do matter. Everybody's life matters, whether you feel like it's so small or so big. You're important.
I like that. Tiziana, for anybody who wants to reach out to you, you want to go ahead and put out your social media handles?
Yeah. So my TikTok is just at Juziana. My Instagram is rare.living.with.juziana. And my website is www.juziana.com.
There it is. We encourage everyone listening to support Gianna's journey, support disability advocacy, support access to education, and more importantly, support people when they speak up for themselves. Tiziana, thank you for reminding us that life is not measured by limitations, but by purpose. Until next time, keep advocating, keep learning, and keep making space for voices that matter. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable. We'll be back soon.